shouting, "We found him." Within 3 days, the George Riquet matter had been escalated to the attention of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On May 19, 1947, an arrest warrant was issued for George Riquet on orders from the War Crimes Branch, Civil Affairs Division, in Washington. George Riquet is wanted as a principal perpetrator in the Nordhausen concentration camp case, the document read. Riquet's immediate reaction was to claim he was being falsely accused. "This was a case of mistaken identity," Riquet declared. In response, the Office of the Deputy Director of Intelligence, Headquarters European Command, had this to say. "The Dr. George Riquet, now employed at Wright Field, and the George Riquet, engineer at Nordhausen, are one and the same person. Dr. Karl Rahr, chief physician at Nordhausen, has been interrogated and states that he knew Riquet and he is now in his late 40s or early 50s, and that there was only one George Riquet at Nordhausen. This group is making arrangements to have Riquet returned to Germany for trial in the Nordhausen concentration camp case." The War Department's Intelligence Division assigned the Chief of Security at Wright Field, Major George P. Miller, the role of escorting Riquet back to Germany. Riquet's 5-year contract was terminated. He was instead going to be a defendant in the Dora Nordhausen war crimes trial. On June 2, 1947, JOA Deputy Director Bosque N. Webb wrote to J. Edgar Hoover, the powerful director of the FBI, alerting him of the situation and sending along Riquet's classified dossier. If the public learned that an Operation Paperclip scientist had been returned to Germany to stand trial for war crimes, the JOA, the Army, the War Department, and the FBI would all have a lot of explaining to do. It was in everyone's interest to keep the George Riquet fiasco under wraps. On August 7, 1947, George Riquet appeared as one of 19 defendants in the Dora Nordhausen trial. The Nazis were charged with the deaths of at least 20,000 laborers who were beaten, tortured, starved, hanged, or worked to death while being forced to build V-2 rockets. The trial, which took place inside a former SS barracks adjacent to the Dachau concentration camp, lasted 4 months and 3 weeks. The prosecution requested that Wernher von Braun be allowed to testify at the trial, but the Army said it was too much of a security risk to allow von Braun to travel to Germany. The Russians could kidnap him, the U.S. Army said. They did not say that von Braun had recently traveled to Germany to marry his cousin and bring her back to Texas with him. At the end of the trial, 15 of the 19 defendants were found guilty. 4, including George Riquet, were acquitted. Then, in an unprecedented move, the Army classified the entire trial record, explains journalist Linda Hunt. The record would remain secret from the public for another 40 years. There was far too much at stake for the U.S. Army to allow the information about what had really gone on in the Nordhausen tunnel complex to get out to the public. The trial record would call attention to the backgrounds of the 115 rocket scientists at Fort Bliss. The future of the United States missile program was too important. The Russians had their rocket scientists, and America needed hers too. Shortly after Riquet was acquitted, back in Washington, D.C., the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force received a call from the State Department. The official identified himself as Henry Cox. The Air Force captain who took Cox's call wrote up a memo of what was said. After exchanged pleasantries, Cox inquired if we had ever returned a specialist to Europe for trial. I thought a moment and, realizing that the Riquet case was in the public domain and in all probability facts known to the State Department since his sister made inquiries, I did not dare deny the story. I, therefore, told Mr. Cox that one Air Force case had been returned to Europe under suspicion, that my recollection was that he was cleared, that in any event, we did not desire to take further chances on the case, and that he had not been returned to the United States. The State Department appears to have bought the story. Ricke was gone, but there was no shortage of Nazis coming to Wright Field to work. On August 22, 1947, one of the Reich's top 10 pilots, Siegfried Knaemeyer, arrived. This was the daring pilot and engineer whom Albert Speer had hoped would help him to escape to Greenland, and whom Hermann Göring called my boy. Knaemeyer is very popular with his fellow nationals since he is a good mixer and free of vanity, read a memo in his intelligence dossier. He is a diligent worker with an inventive mind. He is absorbed by his work and especially enthusiastic about participating in aerial tests. Soon, Knaemeyer's wife, Doris, and their 7 children arrived in America to join him and to become U.S. citizens. The family moved into a large, drafty farmhouse on Yellow Springs Road. Doris Knaemeyer hated provincial life in Dayton, Ohio. In Berlin, the Knaemeyers had a grand home in the Charlottenburg district, with many servants to help take care of the Knaemeyer brood. Raising 7 children by herself in America was not what Doris Knaemeyer had in mind. The difficulties at home did not go unnoticed by Knaemeyer's supervisors at Wright Field. Since the arrival of his family, he seems harassed and neglectful of his personal appearance, read an internal security report. But Knaemeyer was determined to succeed. Assigned to the Communication and Navigation Laboratory at Wright Field, Knaemeyer found his stride. He began to make significant contributions to navigational instruments for his new employer, the U.S. Air Force, no longer part of the Army anymore. Knaemeyer is a genius in the creation of new concepts in flight control, wrote Colonel John Martin, Knaemeyer's superior at the lab. Knaemeyer's friend, Werner Baumbach, Hitler's general of the bombers, had been scheduled to come to Wright Field to work alongside Knaemeyer, but an entry in Baumbach's intelligence dossier noted that there had been a last-minute change. Lieutenant Colonel Baumbach has since been substituted, it read. Baumbach went to Argentina instead to train fighter pilots for Juan Perón. Whether he had been dropped from Operation Paperclip or Juan Perón had offered him a better deal remains a mystery. Werner Baumbach died a few years later after an airplane he was testing crashed into the Rio de la Plata near Uruguay. Also arriving at Wright Field in the summer of 1942 was General Walter Dornberger, newly released from England's Special Camp 11 outside Bryggan, South Wales, formerly Island Farm. Before turning General Dornberger over to the Americans, the British labeled him a menace of the First Order and warned their Allied partners of his deceitful nature. While holding Dornberger for war crimes, British intelligence had eavesdropped on him and recorded what he had said. When the Americans listened to these secret audio recordings, they too concluded that Hitler's former chief of all rocket and research development had an untrustworthy attitude in seeking to turn ally against ally. Still, Dornberger signed a paperclip contract on July 12, 1947, just weeks after his release from prison. Dornberger's skill at manipulation was put to use by Army ordnance, which had him write classified intelligence briefs. America needed to develop missiles regardless of what any naysayers might think, Dornberger believed. Russia strives now only for time to prepare for war before the United States, Dornberger wrote in a classified budget pitch financed by the Ordnance Department in 1948. The United States must decide upon a research and development program that will guarantee satisfactory results within the shortest possible time and the least expense. Such a program must be set up even if its organization appears to violate American economic ideals and American traditions in arms development, Dornberger wrote. At least it could be said that Dornberger remained true to his totalitarian-leaning principles, his belief that democratic ideals and traditions could be ignored in the quest for military supremacy. That the U.S. Army condoned Dornberger's idea appears never to have been made public before. His pitch was presented to Ordnance Department officials at the Pentagon. A copy of the classified document was found in 2012 in Dornberger's personal papers kept in a German state archive. Opposition to Project Paperclip gained momentum with America's scientific elite. On February 1, 1947, the Federation of American Scientists, FAS, met in New York City to ask President Truman to put an end to it. The American scientists saw the Nazi scientist program as a drastic step in the search for military power. When it was learned that some of the 1,000 additional German scientists on the paperclip recruiting list were being hired for short-term military work, followed by longer-term positions at American universities, many were outraged. Certainly not wishing to jeopardize the legitimate needs of the national defense, and not advocating the policy of hatred and vengeance toward our former enemies, we nevertheless believe that a large-scale importation of German scientists is not in keeping with the best objectives of American domestic and foreign policy, the members of FAS wrote. One American scientist was more forthright. Certainly, any person who can transfer loyalties from one ideology to another upon the shifting of a meal ticket is not better than Judas, he said. Albert Einstein was the most esteemed figure to publicly denounce Operation Paperclip. In an impassioned letter written on behalf of his FAS colleagues, Einstein appealed directly to President Truman. We hold these individuals to be potentially dangerous. Their former eminence as Nazi Party members and supporters raises the issue of their fitness to become American citizens and hold key positions in American industrial, scientific, and educational institutions. Another important figure among the opposition was the nuclear physicist Hans Bethe. Bethe had fled Nazi Germany in 1933 and had worked on the Manhattan Project during the war. In The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Bethe and Dr. Henry Sack, a colleague from Cornell University, posed a series of simple questions about Project Paperclip. Was it wise or even compatible with our moral standards to make this bargain, in light of the fact that many of the Germans, probably the majority, were diehard Nazis, Beth and Sack asked. Did the fact that the Germans might save the nation millions of dollars imply that permanent residence and citizenship could be bought? Could the United States count on the German scientists to work for peace when their indoctrinated hatred against the Russians might contribute to increase the divergency between the great powers? Had the war been fought to allow Nazi ideology to creep into our educational and scientific institutions by the back door? Their final question struck at the dark heart of the Nazi scientist program. Do we want science at any price? The condemnation of Project Paperclip by these leading American scientists and others had a ripple effect on the general public. Reporters began searching for leads about individual German scientists' wartime activities, but this proved an almost impossible effort given the program's classified nature. Frustrated by the lack of information, Some Americans sent threatening letters addressed to the German scientists at Wright Field and Fort Bliss. The Army tightened security and surveillance. In Washington, D.C., the War Department was rightly concerned that intense opposition and bad publicity had put the entire program in jeopardy of collapse. And in the winter of 1947, the War Department forbade the further release of information about the program. Despite the precautions, two individuals from the program at Fort Bliss were exposed by an angry public as real Nazis, Mr. and Mrs. Herbert Axter. Herbert Axter, a former lieutenant colonel in the Wehrmacht, had been a Nazi party member since 1940. He was not a scientist, but rather a patent lawyer and an accountant. At Peenemünde, he worked as General Dornberger's chief of staff. His wife, Ilse Axter, was a leader of NS Frauenschaft, a Nazi party organization for women. During a routine investigation of the Axters conducted for their visa applications, neighbors in Germany told Army intelligence officers that Mrs. Axter was a particularly sadistic Nazi. On the Axters' estate, the neighbors said, the couple kept 40 political prisoners, Russians and Poles, whom they used as slave laborers. The neighbors said Mrs. Axter was known to use a horse whip on her servants. This information was first passed on to Rabbi Stephen Wise of the American Jewish Congress and then to the press. These scientists and their families are supposed to have been screened, Wise wrote to the War Department. The Axters prove that this screening is a farce, and that the War Department screeners are entirely incapable of performing this task. The Department of Justice withdrew Herbert Axter's application for legal immigration, but the Axters were not sent home. Eventually, they left Fort Bliss, and Herbert Axter opened a law firm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The War Department cabled USFET, demanding an explanation as to how the Axters got through the screening process. A classified cable was sent back stating that a few ardent Nazis may have slipped into the program based on unavailability of records immediately after the war. Chapter 14. Strange Judgment. The doctor's trial was the first of 12 subsequent war crimes trials at Nuremberg, wherein the U.S. government prosecuted individuals in specific professions, including industrialists, lawyers, and generals, who had served the Third Reich. The first trial, called the Trial of the Major War Criminals, was prosecuted by the four Allied powers. When it ended in October 1946, tensions between the Soviet Union and the United States had escalated to the degree that cooperation between the two nations was no longer possible. The subsequent 12 trials took place at the Palace of Justice, as the others had, but with only American judges and prosecutors. The 23 defendants in the doctor's trial were charged with murder, torture, conspiracy, and atrocity in the name of medical science. Mere punishment of the defendants, said Brigadier General Telford Taylor in his opening statement, can never redress the terrible injuries which the Nazis visited on these unfortunate peoples. But General Taylor reminded the tribunal and the world that one of the central purposes of the trial was to establish a record of proof of the crimes, so that no one can ever doubt that they were fact and not fable, and that this court, as agent of the United States and as the voice of humanity, stamps these acts and the ideas which engendered them as barbarous and criminal. Dr. Leopold Alexander, the Viennese-born American psychiatrist who had first learned of the Luftwaffe's freezing experiments, helped General Taylor write his opening speech. Dr. Alexander's official title was expert consultant to the Secretary of War, but in layman's terms, he was the most influential person involved in the doctor's trial after Telford Taylor. Dr. Alexander worked tirelessly to supply information and answers for the prosecution team as they prepared to go to trial. He conducted hundreds of hours of pre-trial interrogations with the defendants and interviewed scores of witnesses and victims. He was able to converse in both German and English, and he took extensive notes in both languages. Throughout the trial, Dr. Alexander delivered presentations of evidence and cross-examined witnesses. When the trial was over, he would be given credit for writing the Nuremberg Code. Of the 23 defendants, no one outside a small group of American medical military elite had any idea that four of the accused had already worked for the U.S. Army under Paperclip. This fact would remain secret for 40 years. Neither Siegfried Ruf, nor Conrad Schaffer, Hermann Becker-Friesing, nor Oskar Schroeder mentioned this damning fact during the trial. Siegfried Ruf was one of the few physicians who admitted he'd overseen the medical murders at Dachau, but said he did not perform any of the experiments himself. In his defense, he said he didn't believe that what he did was wrong. It was understood that concentration camp inmates who had been condemned to death would be used in the experiments, and as compensation, they were to have their sentences commuted to life in prison, Ruf told the judges. Personally, I would not consider these experiments as immoral, especially in wartime. This line of defense, that extraordinary times called for extraordinary measures, was also used by Schroeder and Becker-Friesing. The strange case of Conrad Schaffer played a unique role in Operation Paperclip. Having invented the Schaffer process to separate salt from seawater, Schaffer was clearly aware that concentration camp prisoners were going to be used in the testing process. Schaffer's superior, Oskar Schroeder, chief of medical services for the Luftwaffe, confirmed this under oath. In May 1944, in order to discuss what further steps should be taken, Becker-Friesing and Schaffer attended a meeting as representatives of my office. As a result of the meeting, it was decided to conduct further experiments on human beings being supplied by the Reichsfuhrer SS, Heinrich Himmler. It was Becker-Friesing who drew up the letter, which was sent to Himmler, requesting more prisoners to conduct experiments on. But Schaffer said he never actually went to Dachau, and no evidence placing him there survived the war. As for eyewitness testimony, all but one of the saltwater experiment victims had been killed. The sole survivor, Karl Hüllenreiner, was located by Dr. Alexander and put on the witness stand. Hüllenreiner did not recognize Conrad Schaffer, but he recognized one of his co-defendants in the dock. Hüllenreiner's testimony proved to be one of the most dramatic events in the doctor's trial. It was June 27, 1947, and Karl Hüllenreiner stood trembling in the hushed courtroom. Small in stature, dark-haired and nervous, he was a broken man. "Now witness," asked U.S. prosecutor Alexander G. Hardy, "for what reason were you arrested by the Gestapo on May 29, 1944? "Because I am a gypsy of mixed blood," Hüllenreiner said. Hüllenreiner's crime was that he had fallen in love with and married a German girl, a violation of the infamous Nuremberg Law that prohibited a non-Aryan from marrying or having sexual relations with a German citizen. After being arrested, Hüllenreiner was sent to three different concentration camps, first Auschwitz, then Buchenwald, and finally Dachau, where he was selected to take part in the seawater experiments being performed by the Luftwaffe. At Dachau, Hüllenreiner was deprived of food, forced to drink chemically processed seawater, and then monitored for signs of liver failure and madness. One experiment among the many stood out in his memory. Without using anesthesia, a Luftwaffe doctor had removed a piece of Karl Hüllenreiner's liver in order to analyze it. Now, from the witness stand, Hulenreiner was asked to identify the Nazi doctor who'd performed this liver puncture on him. "Do you think you would be able to recognize that doctor if you saw him today?" Prosecutor Hardy asked. "Yes," said Hulenreiner. "I would recognize him at once." Hulenreiner stared across the courtroom, his eyes focused sharply on one of the 23 defendants sitting in the dock. Dr. Wilhelm Beigelbuch, 40, the Luftwaffe doctor in charge of the saltwater experiments. Beigelbuch had deep crevices on each side of his mouth and 5 pronounced dueling scars running across his left cheek. As Hulenreiner stared at Dr. Beigelbuch, everyone in the courtroom waited tensely, recalls Vivian Spitz, a young American court reporter whose job it was to take down the testimony. Spitz sat in front of the judges, within clear view of the witnesses and defendants. "Hulenreiner was a little man, and I watched him stand up," she explains. The prosecutor asked Hulenreiner to proceed to the defendant's dock to identify the doctor who'd removed a piece of his liver without anesthesia. "He paused for just a moment," Vivian Spitz remembers, "with his eyes seeming to be fixed on a doctor in the second row of the prisoner's dock. Then, in a flash, he was gone from the witness stand." Carl Hulenreiner sprang into action. To Vivian Spitz's eye, Hulenreiner seemed to leap over the German defense counsel's tables and appeared to be almost flying through the air toward the prisoner's dock. In his right hand, stretched up high in the air, Carl Hulenreiner clutched a dagger, Vivian Spitz recalls. He was reaching for Dr. Beigelbuch, the consulting physician to the German Air Force. There was shock in the courtroom, confusion and mayhem. The Nazis' defense attorneys scrambled to get out of Hulenreiner's way. 3 American military police rushed forward and grabbed Hulenreiner. Vivian Spitz remembers how security subdued Carl Hulenreiner just before he reached Beigelbuch, preventing him from delivering his own brand of justice. It took minutes for order to be restored in the courtroom. The military police set Carl Hulenreiner before presiding judge Walter Beals, who was furious. 70 years old, overworked, and in failing health, Judge Beals clung to the idea that his primary role at Nuremberg was to educate the German people in the ways of American democracy and due process. "Witness," thundered the judge, "you were summoned before this tribunal as a witness to give evidence." "Yes," Carl Hulenreiner meekly replied. "This is a court of justice," roared Beals. "Yes," said Hulenreiner, trembling worse than before. "And by your conduct in attempting to assault the defendant Beigelbuch in the dock, you have committed a contempt of this court." Carl Hulenreiner pleaded with the judge. "Your Honor, please excuse my conduct. I am very upset." The judge interrupted and asked if the witness had anything else to say in extenuation of his conduct. "Your Honor, please excuse me. I am so worked up. That man is a murderer," Hulenreiner begged, pointing to the expressionless Dr. Beigelbuch. "He has ruined my whole life." The judge told Hulenreiner that his statement did not make his conduct forgivable, that he had insulted the court, that it was the judgment of the tribunal that he be confined in the Nuremberg prison for a period of 90 days as punishment for insulting due process. Carl Hulenreiner spoke in a tidy, pleading voice. The power and conviction that had allowed him to almost fly across the courtroom with the intent of stabbing Dr. Beigelbuch with his dagger was gone. Now Hulenreiner was on the edge of tears. "Would the tribunal please forgive me?" Hulenreiner asked. "I am married and I have a small son." He pointed at Dr. Beigelbuch. "This man is a murderer. He gave me salt water and he performed a liver puncture on me. I am still under medical treatment." Carl Hulenreiner pleaded for mercy from Judge Beals. "Please, do not send me to prison." The judge saw no room for clemency. Instead, Beals asked a guard to remove Carl Hollenreiner from the courtroom, referring to him as a prisoner now. "My heart broke," Vivian Spitz recalls. All she could do was lower her head. She was a professional court reporter, and it was inappropriate for anyone to see that she was crying. 60 years later, when recollecting this incident, she still wondered why Judge Beals did what he did. It was impossible to be dispassionate. Why 90 days? Why not 1 or 2 days, just to make a point? After all the torture the witness had suffered, it seemed to me to be an outrageous elevation of process over substance. Carl Hollenreiner was removed from the courtroom. He was led down a long, secure corridor and into the prison complex, the same location where Dr. Beigelbuch and all of the other Nazi war criminals were being held. It had been Dr. Alexander who had made the decision to put Carl Hollenreiner on the witness stand, and in his journal he wrote about how conflicted he felt about his decision. Dr. Alexander had spoken with Hollenreiner 10 days before he testified against Beigelbuch, and he was aware how upset Hollenreiner was, noting in a report how his hands shook. Carl Hollenreiner shared with Dr. Alexander that he suffered from a tremendous feeling of inner rage whenever he thought about what had happened to him at the Dachau concentration camp. Hollenreiner felt powerless, he said. He could close his eyes and see the doctor in front of him who had ruined his life and killed 3 of his friends. Dr. Alexander knew how powerful Hollenreiner's testimony would be. He was the only known victim of the salt water experiments to have survived. Witness testimony was powerful, as his proved to be. The thought of him being confined in a prison with the very doctors who had tortured him was unacceptable to Dr. Alexander, and that night he went to Judge Beals to advocate on Hollenreiner's behalf. The judge showed clemency and released him on bail into Alexander's custody. 4 days later, on July 1, 1947, Carl Hollenreiner was allowed to continue his testimony. He rose to the occasion and provided harrowing details about what dying of thirst does to a man. He described how his friends foamed at the mouth, how they had fits of raving madness before succumbing to an agonizing death. One of the Nazi doctor's defense lawyers, Herr Steinbauer, was given an opportunity to cross-examine Carl Hollenreiner. Steinbauer accused Hollenreiner of lying. "How can there be foam on a mouth which is completely dried out?" Steinbauer asked. Hollenreiner said he was telling the truth. "Listen, Herr Hollenreiner," Steinbauer said. "Don't be evasive as gypsies usually are. Give me a clear answer as a witness under oath." Hollenreiner attempted to answer. "You gypsies stick together, don't you?" Steinbauer interrupted. The exchange could have served as a metaphor for the whole trial. Through the eyes of a Nazi, it was and always would be the Übermenschen versus the Untermenschen. It is why General Taylor's opening remarks sent such a powerful message. It wasn't just the acts of the Nazi doctors that were barbarous and criminal, but the very ideas that had engendered such acts. Late at night, Dr. Alexander wrote a private letter to General Telford Taylor stating how he felt about the Nazi doctors on trial. "I feel that all of the accused today, Schaffer, Becker-Friesing, and Beigelbuch, would admit that this problem, seawater drinkability, could have been solved in one afternoon with a piece of jelly and a salt solution. Instead," Dr. Alexander wrote, "all of these men on the dock slaughtered for gain of scientific renown and personal advancement. They were like Tantalus, a mythical, ambitious ruler who slew his own child for reward." In a letter to his wife, Dr. Alexander penned a fascinating reveal. "Dr. Beigelbuch from Vienna turns out to have been in the same class with me during our final year at medical school, before the war. the way Dr. Alexander remembered it, Beiglebuck was caught cheating and had to leave the school. "He does not recognize me," Dr. Alexander told his wife, "but I regularly recognize him." Two men whose professional lives had begun so similarly had taken such radically different paths. There was another dramatic turning point in the doctor's trial, and that involved the case of Dr. Kurt Blomma. Blomma was admittedly the director of biological weapons research for the Reich, which was not in itself a crime. But there were scores of documents in which Blomma discussed the need to conduct experiments on human beings so as to further plague research at the Bacteriological Institute in Posen, where he was in charge. Blomma's defense, some of which he argued himself, was that he intended to experiment on humans, but that he never actually performed the experiments. Intent, said Blomma, was not a crime. The prosecution had been unable to find any witnesses to testify against Blomma, and Blomma used this fact in his defense. There was the testimony of Major General Walter Schreiber against Blomma from the first Nuremberg trial, but the Soviets had refused to let Dr. Alexander interview Dr. Schreiber himself, so the veracity of his testimony was never independently verified. The prosecution presented many documents in which Blomma discussed with Himmler his plans to experiment on humans, but there were no documents showing Blomma's actual guilt. There was another element of Blomma's defense that the prosecution was completely unprepared for, and that was Dr. Blomma's wife, Bettina, a physician and best-selling author. Frau Blomma meticulously researched experiments that were conducted by the U.S. Office of Scientific Research and Development, OSRD, during the war. This included malaria experiments on Terre Haute federal prison inmates. She also uncovered Dr. Walter Reed's famous 19th-century yellow fever research for the U.S. Army, in which volunteer human test subjects had died. The defense counsel, Robert Zervatsius, picked up on this theme of U.S. Army human experimentation where Blomma's wife left off. Zervatsius had located a Life magazine article published in June of 1945 that described how OSRD conducted experiments on 800 U.S. prisoners during the war. Zervatsius read the entire article word for word in the courtroom. None of the American judges was familiar with the article, nor were most members of the prosecution, and its presentation in court clearly caught the Americans off guard. Because the article specifically discussed U.S. Army wartime experiments on prisoners, it was incredibly damaging for the prosecution. Prison life is ideal for controlled laboratory work with humans, Zervatius read, quoting American doctors who had been interviewed by Life reporters. The idea that extraordinary times called for extraordinary measures, and that both nations had used human test subjects during the war, was unsettling. It pushed the core Nazi concept of the Untermensch to the side. The Nuremberg prosecutors were left looking like hypocrites. On August 6, 1947, the verdicts were read. Seven defendants were given death sentences, and nine were given prison sentences of between 10 years and life, including Beiglebuck, 15 years, Becker-Freising, 20 years, and Schroeder, life. Seven Nazi doctors were acquitted, including Blomma, Schaffer, Ruf, and Veltz. Of Blomma's acquittal, the Nuremberg judges noted, "It may well be that defendant Blomma was preparing to experiment on human beings in connection with bacteriological warfare, but the record fails to disclose that fact or that he ever actually conducted the experiments." Conrad Schaffer returned to work at the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center in Heidelberg, where he assumed Dr. Strughold's former position as chief of staff. Strughold had already set sail for America as part of Operation Paperclip and was now in Texas, serving as professional advisor to Colonel Armstrong, the commandant of the School of Aviation Medicine at Randolph Field. Armstrong had set up a new aeromedical research laboratory there and was in the process of bringing dozens of Hitler's former doctors to Texas to conduct medical research. Hubertus Strughold's job description also included overall supervision of the professional activities of the German and Austrian scientists to be employed by the school. Meanwhile, the FBI was having difficulty getting approval for Strughold's visa application for immigration into the United States. The Bureau had conducted a special inquiry into Dr. Strughold back in Germany. One informant, who had known the subject, investigators learned, said that Strughold had expressed the opinion that the Nazi Party had done a great deal for Germany. He, Strughold, said that prior to Nazism, the Jews had crowded the medical schools, and it had been nearly impossible for others to enroll. To counterbalance this derogatory depiction of Strughold, Dr. Conrad Schaffer was asked to write a letter of recommendation for his former boss. In a sworn statement, written just a few weeks after Schaffer was acquitted at Nuremberg, Schaffer praised Dr. Strughold for his ethical principles while conducting research work. I also know that he strictly refused to take part in or permit scientific research work which was damaging to human health, Schaffer wrote. The following year, Dr. Conrad Schaffer would be on a boat headed for America, an Operation Paperclip contract in hand. As for Dr. Blomma, he was seen as a highly desirable recruit for Operation Paperclip. Blomma allegedly knew more about bubonic plague research than anyone else in the world. But given his former position in Hitler's inner circle, coupled with the fact that Blomma had worn the Golden Party badge, bringing him to America as part of Operation Paperclip remained too difficult for the U.S. Army to justify. But as the Cold War gained momentum, an intense suspicion of the Soviets increased. Even someone like Kurt Blomma would eventually be deemed eligible for Operation Paperclip. Part 4. Only the commander understands the importance of certain things, and he alone conquers and surmounts all difficulties. An army is nothing without the head. Napoleon. Chapter 15. Chemical Menace. It had been nearly a year since State War Navy Coordinating Committee Paper Number 2755 authorized JOA to import 1,000 Nazi scientists from Germany so as to deny them to the Russians. For the JOA, things were not happening nearly fast enough. The number of Operation Paperclip scientists who had come to America in this time frame had nearly doubled, from 175 in March 1946 to 344 in February 1947. But none of these scientists had been granted visas yet. JOA officials perceived State Department official Samuel Klaus to be the man most responsible for the holdup. On February 27, 1947, Klaus was called into a meeting in the Pentagon with his military counterparts. There, JOA Director Colonel Thomas Ford told Klaus that he had a list of German scientists already in the United States whose visas needed to be expedited. He asked Samuel Klaus to sign a waiver that would allow JOA to begin this process. Klaus refused to rubber stamp anything. I told him that of course I could do no such thing, and that certification presupposed that the department should have an opportunity to pass judgment of some kind before affixing the signature, he wrote in a State Department memo. Colonel Ford reminded Klaus of the language in a recent JOA directive dated September 3, 1946. According to the directive, the Department of State was to accept as final the investigation and security reports prepared by JOA, for ensuring final clearance of individuals concerned. Klaus told Ford that he would not sign a document that was essentially a blanket waiver of anything, that he would have to see the list of scientists first. Ford told Klaus that the list was classified and that he did not have the clearance to see it. Klaus still refused to sign off on it. Ford stated in various ways that if I did not accept the paper on behalf of the State Department, he would give the information to several senators who would take care of the department, Klaus wrote of Ford's threat. Colonel Ford accused him of standing in the way of national interest. Colonel Ford's request was likely influenced by information the JOA had recently received from the Office of the Military Government in Germany. After months of negative press attention directed at Operation Paperclip, spearheaded by the Federation of American Scientists, and given further momentum by the American Jewish Congresses having identified the Axters of Fort Bliss as real Nazis, the War Department had asked OMGUS to conduct an internal review of the Operation Paperclip scientists working in the United States. It was OMGUS in Germany that oversaw the reports on all the German scientists issued by Army Intelligence G2. The War Department told OMGUS that it did not want to have to deal with any other exposés. In response, OMGUS sent the War Department 146 security reports that could potentially create scandals were the information contained in them to be revealed. One report pertained to rocket engineer Kurt Debus. Debus was an ardent Nazi. He had been an active SS member who, according to the testimony of colleagues, wore his Nazi uniform to work. Most troublesome was the revelation in his OMGUS security report that during the war he had turned a colleague, an engineering supervisor named Richard Kramer, over to the Gestapo for making anti-Nazi remarks and for refusing to give Debus the Nazi salute. From Nazi-era paperwork, it was clear that Debus had initiated the investigation into Kramer. No one else had heard the conversation between the two scientists. Debus had gone home after work and taken it upon himself to write up a report of what was allegedly said, which he had then submitted in transcript form to the SS. The specifics of the incident made it impossible for the European Intelligence Division of the U.S. Army to cast Kurt Debus as an apolitical scientist trying to survive in a fascist world. Debus had gone out of his way to have a colleague arrested by the Gestapo. Kramer was subsequently prosecuted for treason. According to the report, and as a result of Debus's actions, on November 30, 1942, Kramer was called to Gestapo headquarters and confronted with this damning evidence. The Army intelligence officer assigned to the case, Captain F.C. Groves, explained what happened next. On April 5, 1942, he, Kramer, was dragged before a Sondergericht, a special Nazi court, and sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. Groves's lengthy summary and analysis of the incident was sent to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Debus's deliberate and vicious denunciation of Kramer was not something Army intelligence could disavow, wrote Groves. It was a matter of public record in Germany. An OMGUS report put von Braun on equally shaky footing, and Army intelligence cautioned that given his international profile, pushing the State Department for a visa for von Braun could cause problems. The report revealed that not only had von Braun been an SS officer with the high rank of SS Sturmbannführer, or SS Major, but his membership had been sponsored by Heinrich Himmler. In response, JOA Director Colonel Ford proposed contrary action to what was being advised. Ford believed that the best solution was to get these undesirables on an even faster track toward citizenship. If Klaus signed the waiver, JOA could expedite the process. With Klaus refusing to sign the documents, the situation escalated into a standoff. Klaus left the meeting and did some investigative work on his own. In the months that followed, he learned what had transpired with George Ricke at Wright Field, that Ricke had been returned to Germany to stand trial for alleged war crimes. The information had purposefully been withheld from the State Department. In a memo to the Undersecretary of State, Klaus defended his opposition to the JOA's bullish request to have him sign a blind waiver. That the department's security fears were not baseless was recently demonstrated when a war criminal, wanted for war crimes of a bestial kind, was found here among these scientists to be returned to Germany. Klaus was determined to hold his ground, but so was the JOA. The difficulty for Klaus was that he was outnumbered. The same month that the standoff between the State Department and the JOA began, the Chemical Corps finally imported its first German scientist, an expert in Tobin nerve agent synthesis named Dr. Friedrich Fritz Hoffmann. The U.S. Army had been interested in stockpiling Tobin ever since it obtained its first sample from the robbers' lair in the British zone in Germany in May of 1945. The man in charge of the Tobin nerve agent program for the Chemical Corps was Colonel Charles E. Lukes, commander of the Army Chemical Center at Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland. The 51-year-old Colonel Lukes had dedicated his life to chemical warfare. Born and raised in California, Charles E. Lukes received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Stanford University and first became fascinated by war gas while serving in World War I. During his assignment with the 1st Gas Regiment at Edgewood Arsenal in 1922, his life's path seemed to have been set. While Lukes distinguished himself as an expert rifleman, competing in national rifle and pistol matches and winning awards, chemical weapons fascinated him most. He went back to school, to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, to study chemical engineering, and in 1929 he received a Master of Science degree. By 1935, Lukes was the Technical Director of Chemical Warfare Service, Research and Development at Edgewood. He had served as an officer with chemical weapons ever since. Major Lukes spent the first year of World War II refining the U.S. military's standard-issue gas mask. He even worked with Walt Disney and the Sun Rubber Company to transform the spooky, apocalyptic-looking face protector into a more kid-friendly version with a Mickey Mouse face. In August 1942, Lukes was made commander of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal outside Denver, Colorado, where he was in charge of planning, building, and operating the largest capacity toxic manufacturing plant in the United States. Rocky Mountain produced mustard gas and incendiary bombs on an industrial scale, incendiary bombs that were dropped on Germany and Japan. Lukes was awarded the Legion of Merit for his war service. During the war, the U.S. Army had more than 400 battalions ready for chemical combat. If chemical warfare broke out, the Army expected it would involve mustard gas. 60,000 soldiers trained in chemical warfare were sent into battle with gas masks and protective suits, carrying a small card that explained what to do in the event of a chemical attack. Fortunately, World War II ended without the use of chemical weapons, but experts like Charles Lukes were caught off guard when they learned just how outperformed America's chemists had been by Hitler's. With the discovery that the Nazis had mass-produced previously unknown agents like Tobin and sarin gas came with the realization that if Germany had initiated chemical warfare, it would have been a grossly uneven match. Since war's end, the Army's Chemical Corps had received 530 tons of Tobin, courtesy of the British, who had seized the Reich's colossal cash from the robbers' lair. but the Chemical Corps had yet to produce much tabin on its own, which is why Dr. Fritz Hoffmann had been brought to America under Operation Paperclip. Hoffmann arrived in February 1947 and immediately got to work synthesizing tabin. Nerve agents were Hoffmann's area of expertise. He had synthesized poison gas at the Luftwaffe's Technical Academy, Berlin-Gatow, and also at the chemical warfare laboratories at the University of Würzburg during the war. Fritz Hoffmann was a gigantic man, 6'4", with dark eyes, sharp angular features, and high cheekbones. He kept his hair combed back behind the ears, perhaps with the help of hair oil. Hoffmann was a gifted organic chemist and a contemplative man who also had a PhD in philosophy. He had suffered from polio as a child. According to the State Department, he was one of the minority of individuals recruited into Operation Paperclip who had been anti-Nazi during the war. When Hoffmann was captured at war's end, he carried with him an unusual document, an affidavit from the U.S. Embassy in Zurich, Switzerland, signed by American Consul General Sam E. Woods. The bearer of this document, Dr. Friedrich Wilhelm Hoffmann, was anti-Nazi during the whole war, the document stated. It further explained that Hoffmann's father-in-law, the German economist Dr. Erwin Respondick, had risked life and limb to work as a spy for the Americans during the war. Respondick rendered extremely valuable services to the Allied war effort, wrote Consul General Woods. These services, which are known to the former Secretary of State, the Honorable Cordell Hull, were rendered at great personal risk to himself and family, were performed without compensation, and were so valuable to our cause that every courtesy and help should be accorded to all members of the family, including Respondick's son-in-law, Fritz Hoffmann, the affidavit read. After being interrogated by Army intelligence in Germany, Hoffmann was found fit for exploitation for the Office of the Military Government, United States. He was sent to the Army Chemical Center in Berlin, where he started working for the Chemical Warfare Service until his Operation Paperclip contract was finalized. When Friedrich Hoffmann arrived at Edgewood Arsenal in February 1947, America's premier chemical weapons research and development facility had been producing war gases for 30 years. The 3,000-acre peninsula, thick with field and forest, was located 20 miles northeast of Baltimore, Maryland, on the Chesapeake Bay. Because Fritz Hoffmann was the first German at Edgewood thus far, he was quartered inside a barracks with American soldiers. The top secret research and development division he had been assigned to was called the Technical Command, and it was there that he began work synthesizing new insecticides, rodenticides, and miticides, which meant tabin. Colonel Luke's had been ordered by the Chemical Corps to determine how to produce tabin on an industrial scale under a classified program codenamed AI-13. Army intelligence believed the Soviets' chemical weapons program to be considerably ahead of its own, and the Chemical Corps was under pressure to catch up. The Soviets had captured the entire IG Farben laboratory at Duhern Fort and had since reassembled it outside Stalingrad in the town of Beketovka under the codename Chemical Works No. 91. In addition to having the laboratory and the science, the Soviets had also captured some of the Farben chemists who had worked at Duhern Fort. Through their own version of Operation Paperclip, a parallel exploitation program called Operation Ossa Viakim, the Soviets captured German chemist Dr. von Bock and members of his team. The group was taken to Chemical Works 91, where von Bock, an expert in air filtration systems, D decontamination systems, and hermetically sealed production compartments was put to work. Von Bock's esoteric knowledge gave the Soviets access to critical technical aspects of producing Tauben. The hope was that Fritz Hoffmann could bring the Americans up to speed at Edgewood.